Radio Decidim.
On November 18, 19 and 20, we will celebrate Desitin Fest, the biggest meeting of the Desitin community. This year we will address democracy and technology in times of emergency. Listen to the following keynote by Caroline Sinders.
Hi everyone, thank you so much for coming to my talk, Creating Research-Driven Art. I'm Caroline Sinders, I'm an artist and researcher, and I work at the intersections of civil society and the private sector, looking at the impacts of technology in society and its effects on marginalized groups. I've held residencies with BuzzFeed and iBeam, Pioneer Works, the Mozilla Foundation, Harvard University, and I currently sit in a working group with United Nations on Data Privacy and Children. And I'm an artist with Ars Electronica's AI Lab, as well as a visiting researcher with the Weizenbaum Institute looking at AI and labor. What's important to know is that my background is in photojournalism, research, design, and art, and I see everything through the lens of legibility and research storytelling. These are skills I honed as a photojournalist, and with these skills, I make art, and I do human rights research, again, focusing through the lens of how design and technology affect people and their everyday lives. So what is research-driven art? It's how I define my practice. It's art that is shaped and driven by research, be it quantitative or qualitative. I don't make data visualization, but I could. Or a way to think about it is, what if you made net art or technology-based art but with the same principles as photojournalism? Like photojournalism, research-driven art uses a specific structure and a sense of purpose to constrain it. These constraints work much like how a skeleton works. While they stabilize the practice just as a ribcage stabilizes the body, they do not define the entire practice nor keep it from moving and flexing on its own. In this way, the research I do stabilizes and shapes my art, but does not dictate the outcome. In late May, after the U.S. erupted in protest for the Black Lives Matter movement and after George Floyd's death, I noticed a number of curators and critics remark on social networks about how tech artists, read white and male artists, and their roles in unpacking technology and justice and activism. From this, I decided to write an email, or I decided to write a lecture and article on how art and design can encapsulate usefulness. Over email, the curator and writer, Nora Khan, discussed artistic practices during moments of cultural upheaval. Khan wrote, "How might critical technology work be called on in this moment to do more? Coded design work has that capacity. Hybrid research practices can explain and expose the logics of racial capitalism, but under the auspices of artistic collaboration can enact critique and make an argument through process and through a built system." This idea of usefulness in interdisciplinary work is a key and necessary part of a research-driven arts practice, and it is directly extremely inspired by Tonya Bergueira's Arte Util methodology, which means utilitarian art. Arte Util draws on artistic practices to imagine, create, and implement tactics that change how we might act in society, again, heavily focused on usefulness, on tool building, and on communities. Khan, in her email to me, highlighted the strengths of work stretching across many domains, making art a necessary Trojan horse to discuss useful change. This is where I turn to the work of American artists Frances Singh, Joanna Mull, Adam Harvey, Mimi Onowa, Forensic Architecture, and others. These artists are pulling from research or investigatory-based practices and with work that manifests into a variety of outputs, artifacts, writings, and education. The practices of American artists, or the anonymous group that creates ScanMap, an online website that is scanning and tracking police scanners so that protesters can better know how police are responding to protests. Both of these are great examples of social justice and human rights-driven art. With ScanMap's current work on tracking police scanners, or American artists' work, I'm Blue, If I Was Blank, I Would Die, and My Blue Window, two pieces that comment on the structure and violence of modern police forces. Other examples of social justice, research-driven art and artistic practices are works like The Hidden Life of an Amazon User by Joanna Mull, or Adam Harvey's V-Frame research, which came out of his numerous collaborations with the human rights archiving group, the Syrian Archive, or the investigative work of forensic architecture. One example of a research and social justice-based arts practice is Mimi Onowaz. Onowaz's research work on the politics and injustices of data sets have resulted in artworks like The Library of Missing Datasets and the widely cited and canonical zine, The People's Guide to AI, written with Diana Nuceda. These pieces and artists occupy a liminal space of research, journalism, and art. These four mentioned works can be viewed solely as art or as research, but are much more richly seen when viewed as research-based artistic practices. And in this context, design and art are the same for me. While it's a wordy description, it rings true of the intentions of the work. These works aren't just to bear witness, so that alone would be worthwhile. They research, they question, they provocate, and they offer a solution to a problem. This should not be viewed as a form of techno-solutionism, however. The solutions that the artists, technologists, and researchers I've mentioned are providing are not meant to create an end-all to all other potential solutions, but rather serve to offer temporary or open-source fixes or gaps in inequity and violence created by society, and thus are poetic witnesses to those gaps. This kind of band-aid is a similar space in where I pursue my own practice. Band-aids exist as necessary provocations or patches, while participatory design and deconstruction with artists, human rights researchers, activists, technologists, and communities can overhaul the system or destroy systems together. This togetherness and collaboration is key, though, but nonetheless, provocations within art and design can create imaginaries for new realities. I'd like to quickly show you some projects and explain where they came from. As I've stated earlier, I am a human rights researcher and an artist, and my research work deeply informs and influences my artwork. And even when I start with an art idea, I often apply a deep research methodology to it. Anything that interests me, I dive in deeply. I don't know how to necessarily take a small step or a small sip, if you will, of something. I have to understand it and immerse myself in it. One project I'm going to talk about is Social Media Breakup Coordinator, which is an art project, which has come out of my nearly 8 years of studying online harassment and how systems can create harassment. Broadly, the way I describe my work is that I look at the affordances of technology. I know how design functions inside of software, and this background I have in product design and in photojournalism informs how I interrogate and look at technology. So when I look at the affordances of technology, what I'm asking is, how do UX and UI decisions mitigate harassment? How does software design affect the technical structure of software? Can design mitigate harassment? Can it amplify it? They can. Think about it. If you were being harassed, what does the system allow you to do? What can you do to create safety in that space? And can you be safe? My research focuses on the harassment of everyday users and then journalists who can face really large threats like governmental censorship or surveillance, all the way to regular, what we can think of as drive-by harassment. Pardon me, meaning people that kind of appear like they zoom in and out. They come in to your timeline, leave one piece of harassing content, and then leave. This research that I've been conducting has been supported by different organizations like the Harvard Kennedy School and the Open Technology Fund. And what you see here on this page are different screenshots of articles and research, like longer-term research that I've been conducting, as well as on this page too. But this online harassment research, it inspires art as well. Social Media Breakup Coordinator comes out of this space, this research space of studying how content moves online and what we can do to react to this content or stop it. And in the case of harassment, how people relate to being harassed online, how they understand harassment, and the different ad hoc solutions they create to try to mitigate or respond to this harassment. I also look at how we as a society respond to being online. The online space is a very structured, very designed space. Everything around us is designed. So I'm looking at the new kinds of anxieties and tensions that come up within these spaces. One thing I've noticed, especially from my research with the Open Technology Fund, where I worked with journalists who were experiencing harassment in locations like Pakistan, India, Palestine, Mexico, Guatemala, Canada, Germany, United States, and others. I also worked with these journalists to try to create, to one, study the harassment they were facing, and then two, through participatory design methods, create solutions that they would like to see inside of these technology platforms. For example, with the Online News Association in Ciudad de Mexico, we workshopped together different kinds of solutions to improve online harassment reporting, as well as new potential privacy filters. This is to be published in the next month within a paper with Knowledge Future Groups at Harvard. So one thing I've noticed from my research work with victims of harassment, as well as journalists who face harassment, is that regardless of technical background or job, because this is something I hear journalists say a lot, journalists, or rather victims, feel like they shouldn't be upset by what is said to them online. But you should be. It's okay to be hurt and affected by someone calling you dumb or someone sending you something as egregious as a rape threat. Those two actions, in their extremes, are supposed to hurt. So as a researcher, I look at these anxieties and traumas. And as an artist, I create explorations and interventions around them. Social Media Breakup Coordinator is this performance piece that explores the very intertwined and interconnections of our online and offline lives. And this piece has gone through three iterations since 2015. I'm exploring the connections between our digital tools and human interventions. Where do algorithms fail and humans must intervene? As users of social media, people live their most beautiful, angry, complex, and complicated lives online. And I'm exploring a series of solutions following someone breaking up with social media, and then how to coordinate that decoupling from the platform with the individual person. This decoupling sort of encapsulates itself into a similar job that a social media coordinator would take for an ad agency, sort of being in charge of someone's account. Like an algorithm in this performance piece, I am creating a series of solutions that can be combined for a variety of situations. Perhaps following starting a brand new job, changing schools, friend breakups, ghosting, and even actual romantic breakups, as well as a myriad of other kinds of issues people have online. Every participant sitting with me as the coordinator signs a legally binding document drafted by the lawyer Fred Jennings. This document outlines that I am not a therapist and I am not held liable for damages. Then users fill out a 21-point user quiz, which I prescribe answers out of a small algorithm I handwrote with less than 40 suggestions. These suggestions are then puzzle pieced together, so the user feels like they are receiving highly personal advice when in fact it is algorithmically generated. Effectively, I am a therapist chatbot. Social Media Breakup Coordinator is also a comment on the United States' lack of healthcare and mental health support, as well as the growing gig economy. So effectively in this project, I am a gig economy therapist, as well as a digital security trainer and advice giver. So for a few dollars and 15 minutes, people fill out a survey and I give them real feedback. While it started off giving this sort of algorithmic feedback, me mimicking this real life chatbot, it turned into a short feedback session. And the questions and feedback people are getting in the interactions pulls from my very, very real research of seeing the general anxieties people have about being online. It's also exploring this idea of expendable help, but how anxiety about the internet isn't really taken seriously, though it should be. Throughout this project, I've created a series of public data sets about these anxieties. Social Media Breakup Coordinator was originally shown in 2015 at Baby Castles. And again, in February 2019, I took over Baby Castles again to host an entire month of Social Media Breakup Coordinator with new artwork, a video game arcade, and weekly talks featuring Fei Lu, Pamela Lau, Jacqueline Maybe, Charles Bukowski, Molly Soda, as well as others. Video games that were installed were Wrong Box by Molly Soda and Aquim, Museum of the Saved Image by Flan, Yet Another Exhausted Day by Candleman Games, Attack of the Terms and Conditions by Maze486, Wonders of the Internet by Let Off Studios, and Valentine Doom by Doug Doug Ugg, and Sub-Zero. The games themselves, combined with talks and performances, were all mediations on the problems and anxieties within social media. We created a moving algorithm projected on the wall, inspired by our workshops, and at the end of the exhibit, all while still holding social media breakup coordinator sessions. What you see here is Lauren Gardner, one of the curators, exploring social media, or exploring the algorithm we created during the 3 weeks that Social Media Breakup Coordinator was gathering this public data. This data was also all gathered with consent from our participants. I also curated a series of posters and art pieces on disconnecting with technology and social media from artists like Sadat Harry, Merritt Kay, Helen Shewolf Singh, Salomia Siga, and myself. And as you see, here's me in session as the coordinator inside of Baby Castles. Later in December 2019, I won a residency with Academy/Solitude, and I created a critical design chatbot. The bot is designed to respond to questions and care for the victim, as well as a series of open source best practices and guides on what to do when facing a variety of online harassment. This bot is an extension of the Social Media Breakup Coordinator project. This bot also tells the user it shouldn't exist, but it does to fill this void that's been created by platforms. The help and feedback the bot is providing should actually be provided by real people and trained professionals on these platforms, but that doesn't exist. Until that kind of help infrastructure exists, this bot will. This bot is directly inspired by actual bot design I used to do at IBM Watson as a natural language process design researcher, and I made this in conjunction with Alex Fifigea of Camusi Labs, who built the bot software. But the actual content you see is content that I have researched from my online harassment work, as well as security work, as well as security and privacy suggestions I give real victims that also come from my collaborations with many different privacy and security professionals. So my work likes to really deal with this tension and plays with this line of being useful, but also trying to highlight deeper issues at play. I like that my work can be useful and utilized, and I also like that it can point out or highlight flaws inside of society. Another project I've worked on is Higher Resolutions, made with Hyphen Labs in 2019, where we were invited to be the lead artist at the Tate Exchange at the Tate Modern. Higher Resolution ran for 2 weeks in September 2019 and used interactive artwork, talks from international technology experts, and hand-on workshops to examine the state of power and privacy online. From widespread surveillance to how AI is shaping human culture and relationships to the threats that emerging technology can pose to human rights generally. Artists and speakers hailed from Amnesty International, Change.org, the BBC, the Carnegie Trust, and other international organizations. A major reason I was so excited to work with Hyphen Labs was the ability to bring in policy researchers, political activists, and social justice work as well as artists. I believe it's important when creating activist and social justice work as artists, we also avoid replicating unintentional work done by activists out in the field. Instead, we can work directly with those activists. When fighting data surveillance, the way to create change is to work together and create levers of pressure in the public, and arts institutions are a necessary part of that public lever. We need to avoid creating work done only in the space of art, and we should seek collaboration with other activists and researchers who are also working on identical causes. The 2 weeks of programming unfolded in a unique space designed to mimic the different layers of privacy we toggle between the online and the offline, as well as a floor schematic highlighting the privacy concerns in our everyday lives. The floor schematic also mapped a regular person's journey in the city of London and how many different points of surveillance that a regular person interacted with in their everyday life. These metaphors we were using to describe the varying forms of intimacy and privacy online were things like the town hall, which is the most public, which is an analog of Twitter. For example, even if you don't have a lot of followers, anyone can share your content that you've posted on Twitter at any time, as long as your setting is public. Our next metaphor was the park bench, which is an analog of Facebook, which is semi-public. For example, to access any content on Facebook, you do really need to be signed in. And since Facebook does have different privacy settings, this really big community of Facebook is much more like a gated community or a garden, something that you have to walk in and enter to then access the content. The next metaphor was the semi-private, which is the living room, an analog of WhatsApp. A living room conversation with a door closed can feel very public or can feel like you're gathered with a large group of people, but it actually is an intimate space, much like a salon. WhatsApp mimics that feeling by being an SMS texting-based app. The most private is the lure of the bedroom, an analog of intimate text conversation. So we built these physical manifestations throughout the floor of the Tate Exchange, and the one you see here is the park bench. We also had art installations that spotlight the modern perils, or the perils of modern technology like facial recognition, website tracking, harmful content, and harmful content recommendation algorithms. And what you see here is someone voting on different things, different features to ban, like website tracking or facial recognition. We also create tear-off truisms describing surveillance capitalism. The goal of the project was to bring conversations of privacy with policymakers into the white cube space, to transform these conversations and make them more actionable and tangible for museum goers. How often does a lead of an advocacy campaign get to engage with people who sign their campaigns or actually engage with art organizers? They don't really interact or intersect that frequently. Another example of a research-driven social justice art project is Feminist Dataset, which started in 2019 as a response to the many documented cases and problems of technology and bias in machine learning. It is a critical research and art project that examines bias in machine learning through all the steps of the machine learning pipeline, from data collection, data training, neural networks, and then imagining new forms of user interface, as well as the projected creation of a feminist artificial intelligence system. The project is inspired by the work of the Maker Movement, Critical Design, Arte Utile, the Critical Engineering Manifesto, Xenofeminism, and the Feminist Principles of the Internet. So Feminist Dataset is this multi-year project using intersectional feminism as a framework for investigating machine learning. It's trans-inclusive and focusing on racial justice. It's extremely process-driven, so the outputs of the project or the artifacts are things like papers, zines, and workshops on data and machine learning. The workshops here are key since they are a mechanism to think through what community-driven, equitable data collection can look like. In workshops, we discuss what is intersectional data, what does it mean, what does it look like. We talk about Professor Kimberly Crenshaw's work, the creator of the term intersectionality. But we also unpack intersectional feminism in writing. For example, let's look at an article about income inequality. An intersectional feminist article would highlight that white women, black women, indigenous women, Latinx women, and trans folks of different races are all paid different amounts. So an article that simply represents all women as a monolith is not intersectional and cannot be in the data set. Within our workshops, community members then research and submit written data, be it poems, text, blog posts, transcripts, whatever, that have the foundation of intersectional feminism in them. It doesn't have to be about feminism, but like the previous article, it has to be utilizing intersectional feminist frameworks. The only time my hand as a creator appears is to remove non-intersectional data, and I am extremely firm about this. Racists and TERFs need not apply. Feminist Dataset operates in a similar vein to Thomas Thwaites' Toaster Project, which you see here, which is a critical design project in which Thwaites builds a commercial toaster from scratch, from digging up and melting iron ore to building circuits, then completely from scratch, and creating a new plastic toaster body mold. Thwaites was commenting on the ubiquity of this common everyday object and wanted to show actually how difficult it is to sort of make something like a toaster, but also how extractive it is. Feminist Dataset takes a critical and artistic view on software, and particularly machine learning. So what does it mean to thoughtfully make with machine learning, to carefully reconsider every angle of making, iterating, and designing? Every step of this process needs to be thoroughly re-examined through a feminist lens, and like Thwaites' toaster, every step has to work. Metaphorically, my AI may be as misshapen as this toaster, since I'm having to remake or reconfigure every step. But that's also part of the process, and that's part of the artistic comment, is that it's it actually isn't possible to make an entirely feminist AI system. Here's an image of feminist data set when installed at the Victoria and Albert Museum in the Artificially Intelligent exhibit. My current project, named TRK, or Technically Responsible Knowledge, is an open source project that examines wage inequality and creates open source alternatives to data labeling and training AI, and is a part of the Feminist Data Set project, which is now focusing on data labeling and the systemic issues around labor, invisibility, and the creation of maintaining data structures and training data algorithmic models. TRK was funded by the Mozilla Foundation, was created by Cade Diem, Ian Arnaud Fuma, and Rainbow Unicorn. In 2019, I interviewed research labs, artists, startups who use Mechanical Turk style services, and microservice workers across Crowdflower, Fiverr, and Mechanical Turk. I even became a Mechanical Turker myself for a few weeks. TRK, again, is this alternative open source tool for dataset training and labeling, a time-consuming but integral aspect of machine learning that must be completed in part by a human. You can't unhuman this part. This tool offers a wage calculator that helps visualize livable wage to those that will be responsible for completing the task. As an artist who uses AI as a material to explore and make art, I was struck by how many startups and research labs use Mechanical Turk-style platforms without any thought given to the payment structure determined for the workers on the network. Mechanical Turk and similar platforms have had well-documented cases of horrendous worker-related issues, such as severely underpaid contracts. In many instances, even if the lab or individual is trying to price equitably, the interface of Mechanical Turk works against it. If the machine learning pipeline is death by a thousand cuts, think of TRK as one band-aid for one small cut. The project doesn't propose a solution for all issues related to machine learning or even a major one for Amazon's Mechanical Turk. So many issues related to machine learning are issues of a deeper, more ingrained societal inequity, which can only be addressed through large shifts and restructuring in society or legislation. But within that, as a designer and researcher, I try to look at what kinds of research or work can alleviate or expose those issues. TRK focuses on, through pricing structures, platform incentives, and the invisible nature of gig work, clients underprice, undervalue, and fundamentally misunderstand how tasks are handled in human-as-a-service platforms. Part of the design thinking behind TRK is to examine equity and transparency within the interfaces and the design of tools, and what kinds of problems tool design, UX, and UI create inside of technology. Inspired by the Data Sheets for Datasets white paper, TRK injects plain text information into the dataset with information that includes what the dataset is, why it was created, who made it, when and where, and how many different people worked on it, and if those workers consent, where they're from. UX, or user experience design, is a utilitarian intelligence, focusing on architectural layouts, usability, and user flows. But design has a politics to it. Design can suppress or uplift content. Design, much like technology, isn't neutral. As an artist, I use design as a material to confront and comment on the slickness and inequity of for-profit technologies. Very similar to Arte Util, I want to make things or remake things in the way of how I want to interact with the internet. I want to focus on usable things and useful things. I'm an artist that deals with trauma and the trauma and violence of others. Sometimes the tools I use don't quite work, so how can I make them better? An interface is useful and expressive. I say this to you as an American based in Berlin, but I've noticed culturally how the United States relates to design as an artistic medium versus Europe. And design inside the US is not necessarily viewed as an artistic practice. So I try to encourage Americans in particular to reflect back on critical design, the methodology of removing capitalism from the structure of design. Design can be a tool, much like technology and much like art, to create political small acts of resistance and change. What kinds of design can we make when we stop viewing it through a Western Silicon Valley, neoliberal, and extremely capitalist lens? We've seen code, art, and art made without the constraints of capitalism. It's time for design to do that. Critical design, social justice, and design justice are needed now more than ever for tool making, for design to confront how it's perpetuated white supremacy and change its relationships to power. Design can be an actuator for change, but design alone is not an entire solution towards injustice in society and technology. Design can confront a problem while acknowledging that it is part of the problem. Design can visualize or highlight parts of systemic injustice, but design must unpack and confront its role in contributing to injustice in technology, especially technology in Silicon Valley. I use design as an artistic practice and as a lever to create the usefulness to explore problem solving. Similarly, how anonymous programmers and artists create scan map to provide a solution for surveilling the police, or Everest Pimpkin created a tool to blur images for people to use at protests, design can sit in a space to solve small problems that are part of bigger spaces and bigger issues. My approach to design thinking proposes a decommodification of art and situates it as a process and investigation. Artistic approaches to problems allow for collaborations that might not happen in other fields. And this way, art's role in social justice and human rights makes space for new kinds of work in a way that other fields could traditionally not let those projects exist. What does change look like? It has to be interdisciplinary across many fields of art, activism, policy, and social justice working together and not separately. Thank you so much for your time. If you have any questions, I'd love to chat. Please drop me a note if you feel so inclined. Thank you.